The title of the lecture this afternoon is The Counterfeit Infinity. The Counterfeit Infinity. Here are the quotations I'll use to frame this chapter. First, from Aldous Huxley. Euphoric, narcotic, pleasantly hallucinant, all the advantages of Christianity in alcohol, and none of the defects. Second, Ken Kesey. Don't give me your occupation game labels. We're beautiful people, ascendants from your robot junkyard. For a year now, we've been in the Garden of Eden. Acid opened the door. It was the Garden of Eden, an innocence and a ball. Thirdly, Timothy Leary. My crime is the ancient and familiar one of corrupting the minds of youth. This charge is a valid one. And lastly, Baudelaire. Alas, man's vices, horrible as they are supposed to be, contain the positive proof of his taste for the intimate, infinite. The man wanted the dream. Now the dream will govern the man. The third defining feature of the counterculture that we're going to be looking at is its resort to the drugs, particularly the psychedelics, to achieve a transcendental consciousness and something in the area of an infinity. For those within the movement, drugs have attained an almost sacramental importance, virtually for some the bread and wine of the new community, while for many outside the movement, they are almost spectral horror, a phobia that at times has been on a par almost with communism. Some describe them as the cortical vitamins or the honey of the spirit, and they praise the fifth freedom, the right to get high. Others damn them as instant insanity, describing their advocates, such as Timothy O'Leary, as laxative salesmen with their delusions of grandeur, a new breed of holy rollers living in a psychedelic Disneyland. In other words, you immediately have a polarization of opinion with extremely irrational emotionalism on either side very often. And this hardly allows us any objective room for a consideration of their real significance. But the psychedelic movement really deserves serious attention, both as the fact that it's the feature of the counterculture itself, as well as the fact that in the psychedelic movement are combined two important trends. On the one hand, the age-old perennial taste for infinity, as Baudelaire describes it, and on the other hand, the urgent modern search for a new consciousness, a new consciousness which may be a shortcut solution to the problem of man. Pascal once observed, as he looked around the world, most of man's troubles come from his not being able to sit quietly in his chamber. More recently, Huxley has noted that the urge to transcend self-consciousness and selfhood is one of the principal appetites of the human soul. In other words, for centuries, there's been this search for the attainment of the ideal, which the Greeks called ataraxia, the ideal of a quiet calm or deep inner contentment, which is beyond the restlessness and the frustration and the tensions of normal living. Usually, people have searched for this ataraxia via philosophy and religion. But always, there's been the parallel search for shortcuts, what Baudelaire called paradise in a single swoop. And it's little wonder that when these shortcuts were found, often they were immediately given the halo of almost quasi-divinity. So, for example, peyote was divine to the Aztecs, coca to the Incas, and soma to the Vedas, and ambrosia to the Greeks. Probably all these were discovered accidentally, and certainly the details of the discovery are lost in prehistory. But as soon as they were discovered, their use became intertwined in the blurry realm of religion and magic and private illumination. And this is the age-old perennial taste for infinity. But the point today is that through chemistry, modern man is heir to this age-old search and has added to the urgency of the search his own quest for a new consciousness. And modern man needs this new consciousness as a solution to the problems of man in the post-Christian era. In other words, certain are looking towards the psychedelics to supply a limited chemical means towards a greater psychic end. And they hope that this end will lead to a reformulation of the whole idea of man, counterbalancing technology, and even making a utopian society possible. Now, this may seem a very high promise, but nothing short of this is promised by certain of the prophets of the psychedelic movement. Charles Reich, speaking of Consciousness 3, and having in mind that mind-expanding drugs are integral to his vision of Consciousness 3, claims this: only Consciousness 3 can make possible the continued survival of man as a species in this age of technology. And Tim Leary is no less extravagant in his own claims. Human beings born after the year 1943 belong to a different species from their progenitors. Today, our favorite concepts are standing in the way of a flood tide, 2 billion years building up. The verbal dam is collapsing. Head for the hills or prepare your intellectual craft to flow with the current. In other words, what these and a host of others are promising is really a kind of paradise now through cosmic consciousness. A new answer to the problem of man's inability to live with his own normal consciousness. So you have this picture of man east of Eden, where his desires are looking back to Eden, desiring to recover a time that's lost. So modern man dreams of life as play, in the style of the Dutch philosopher Huizinga. Or he dreams of love as pregenital polymorphous perversity, in the style of Freud. Or he dreams of history as a stage beyond timelessness where the clocks are shattered, in the style of Marcuse. And parallel to all these other themes, which are all expressing this idea of back to a paradise now, you have this perennial taste for infinity. So you have the psychedelic drugs as a feature of the counterculture, but combining these two interesting trends, the age-old perennial taste for infinity and the new search for a consciousness that will solve the problem of man's dilemmas today. What I'm going to try and attempt to do is to analyze the story and the claims surrounding the psychedelics, and then to try and delve underneath the unrestrained euphoria on the one side and the reactionary ignorance on the other side, and then to examine the drugs for their philosophical and religious significance and to see where their place is within the counterculture today. First of all, two preliminary qualifications to show you which areas we're working in. First, I'm only going to be concerned with the psychedelics, not with the stimulants or depressants or any of the other drugs. Many of our generation have also taken speed and heroin and opium or even aeroplane glue and things like this. And some of these drugs range from the very trivial to the extremely dangerous. And the trivial are hardly worthy of our attention and the others are well documented. But the psychedelic movement, on the contrary, really shows the resort to drugs at its highest and its most hopeful. And it's in this sense that the drugs at their best that I want to show how close it is to the nerve of the counterculture. The second qualification is that I'm not going to use their former name, hallucinogenics, or the very old name that they were called, psychotomimetics, the fact that they were a mimic of psychosis, but rather the more modern name, psychedelic, a word that was coined in 1957 by Humphrey Osmond and describes their mind-expanding qualities. Now, as I'm sure you know, the common feature of all these drugs is well known. The effect common to all these drugs appears to be to trigger a release which slips the leash of the normal, rational, waking mind. In other words, which slips the leash of the normal waking mind which reasons logically, which separates the self from the external world, and which quantifies reality into colors, shapes, smells, and sounds. This is disinhibited. In its place, a transcending consciousness is achieved. And several of the possible features of this could be that maybe identity is submerged into a feeling of oceanic unity, or that linear thinking gives way to a kind of flooding instant awareness, or that normal patterns and colors and sounds often take on an existence for themselves, extremely intensified, and sometimes this produces a crossover of the sensations. The explosive possibilities of all this, this transcendence, were glimpsed early on by William Blake. You remember Blake's famous sentence? If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. But it was much nearer to our own time that a more accurate understanding of its scientific possibility was first shown. And this came in the work of William James, whose book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, was the first to delve into so many of these areas. In 1902, after experimenting with nitrous oxide, he wrote a passage which has since become classic, and almost every book on drugs quotes this somewhere. James writes, "One conclusion was forced on my mind at that time, and my impression of its truth has ever since remained unshaken. It is that our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness. whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus and add a touch they are there in all their completeness. And no account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness disregarded. Then he finishes, looking back on my experience, they all converge towards a kind of insight to which I cannot help ascribing some metaphysical significance. Today, the doors of perception are not just glimpsed. They've been really blasted open with chemicals. And more recent writers are hotly impatient with the normal perceptions, calling for a constant transcendence that's beyond the normal rational waking consciousness. A recent writer, Colin McGlashan, writing about dreams and the way they escape our normal consciousness, says, "Dreams are a file smuggled into the space-time cell where man lies captive, a cell whose walls and ceilings are our five senses, and whose warders are the inflexible concepts of logic." In other words, now the normal consciousness is seen as a prison, and the urge by whichever means, dreams, drugs, or whatever, is to transcend and to escape to a new freedom. In all these understandings, the psychedelic drugs are related to the mind as a microscope is to the eye, both expanding the powers of apprehension, vision, and awareness. So this is the first qualification. We're dealing with the psychedelics. A second preliminary qualification is that any general principle or experiences must be interpreted, or sometimes reinterpreted, in the light of the set and the setting of the user. In other words, his character and the circumstances under which he takes the drugs. So you ought to expect widely differing reactions to the very same drug. For example, one man might be a paid research volunteer, and he'll experience one thing. Another man might be a curious artist who's searching for some aesthetic consciousness. Another man might just be merely a group status seeker, and he'll experience yet another thing. While yet another man will be using the drugs to search for God, and may have quite a different experience again. In other words, the set and the setting is absolutely crucial. And so you should remember that as you remember maybe your own trips and so on. Kenneth Keniston cites that there are three basic categories of drug takers. And this is quite a useful three. First, the tasters. Second, the seekers. And thirdly, the heads. He used this 5 or 6 years ago. Since become a very common way of looking at it. The tasters are those who use the drugs only occasionally and usually experimenting. The seekers are those who use them regularly, but not with any lifestyle built around them, apart from a general search for relevance. And the heads are that, well, obviously that small but highly vocal minority who have a totally turned on ideology and for whom the drugs are almost a passport to their part of the subculture. Now what I want to do, and this is the part that many of you may think is totally irrelevant, depending on how much knowledge you have in background, is go through the history of some of the psychedelic drugs, and then the second half we'll get into the arguments concerning what is the nature of the experience and what are the implications that they give to it in relation to yoga or Christian experience, etc. So this first part, if anyone wants to rejoin us after a while, you're welcome. First, let's look at marijuana. The history of any of these is valuable as a background, especially for objective discussion. As I say, it's very difficult to know what to leave out and what to include, depending on who your audience is. Generally speaking, in all these drugs, there are three distinct periods in their discovery. The first stage is the pre-Western history. The second stage, usually, is the period of serious but limited research in the West. And the third stage is the era of popularization. But first, let's start with marijuana. As I say, some of this is very basic for some of you. As you know, the marijuana plant is cannabis, so named by a Swedish scientist in the 18th century. But known as Indian hemp, it's one of the oldest domestic plants known to man. Many of you have seen it growing. It's a tall, weedy, annual herb, first cousin of the fig tree or the hop. And it's distinctive for having the male and female flowers on separate plants. The stems of the male plant go into making the rope, hemp, while it's the stems of the female plant that give off a resinous exudation. It's golden yellow in color and minty in smell, a heavy minty smell. And in India, where this is most widely grown of all, it's made from the plant into one of three things. The first is bhang, B-H-A-N-G, a decoction smoking mixture which is derived from the cut tops of the female plants that have been uncultivated and where the resin content is decidedly low. Interestingly, in India, this is scorned by all but the poorest, where, of course, in the West, it's much more popular. The second variety is ganja, G-A-N-G-A, and this is a specially cultivated and harvested grade of hemp. And again, the tops are cut and used for all sorts of things, from smoking mixture to sweetmeats and so on. But the important thing is, again, it's specially harvested, but the resin is not extracted. And this, for a long while, was a licensed industry in India. The third one is charas. And this is the pure, unadulterated resin drawn from the best cultivated plants, extracted from the flowers. And this is known in the West as hash. The modern history of marijuana begins in China, where there is evidence in the year 2737, the emperor, who was writing a book on pharmacy, knew much more about hemp than many of us know today. Already it was troubling the Chinese moralists, and it was being criticized as a liberator of sin. Criticized by some, but commended by others as the delight giver. The emperor himself, who was something of a medical expert, prescribed it as medicine for a whole series of things, including female weakness, gout, rheumatism, malaria, beriberi, constipation, and absent-mindedness. So this is the first references to marijuana. From China, it came further west to India, and it was in India that it really came into its own. Probably, it had been known prior to 800 BC, but certainly since then, it's become intertwined in the religion and philosophy of India, recorded both in the Vedas, the sacred writings, and certainly evidenced amply down in the bazaar. There's an Indian saying, "Bhang is the joy giver, the sky flyer, the heavenly guide, the poor man's heaven, the soother of grief. No god or man is as good as the religious drinker of bhang." Gordon Wasson, a Harvard mycologist, a mushroom expert and scholar, argues that the Rig Veda, the early Hindu poems of creation, devote at least one-tenth of all the psalms and hymns, one-tenth of over 1,000 of them, to celebrating the plant god Soma. Some even argue that yoga only arose in India as a means of altering consciousness after Soma, the plant, was no longer available. And it's certainly widely believed today that Lord Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, smokes marijuana, and on his birthday, marijuana paste with almond milk is drunk as an offering to the gods. Many of the gurus use ganja as beginning to sadhana, the yogic path of discipline, and they use it just as a simple means to distract the mind from the rush of the world. What is clear, though, is that its relationship to alcohol in India is exactly the opposite of what it is in most of our countries. For the Indian, it's alcohol that's related to passion and aggression, and marijuana that leads to calm and detachment. From India came further west into the Middle East, where the early stories are very strange and bizarre. The Greek historian Herodotus describes the Scythians, who before they went into battle threw the hot hemp seeds onto stones that were heated and inhaled the vapors, and then charged into battle, oblivious of the wounds. And there was evidence of various strange customs, such as in Tibet, where they emulsified the hemp brew in warm human fat, and served this as a drink in chalice of human skulls, and used this in their rituals. But the most colorful stories in the Middle East all center around the legendary Hassani Saba, the so-called old man of the mountain. Probably he lived around 1090 AD, just about prior to the First Crusade, where he lived in a strong mountain fortress near Baghdad, straddling the caravan route to Mecca. The old man of the mountain was a fanatical Muslim, trying to restore the world to the truth of the prophet. So he saw it as his sacred duty to purge the world of false prophets, and he did this by implementing a new secret weapon, political assassination. His disciples and devotees were a dreaded group called the Assassins, and their reign of terror lasted for hundreds of years, until it's said that 12,000 of them were wiped out in one battle by Genghis Khan in the 13th century. His full name was Hashishin, was linked with hashish, an assassin. And you can understand his secret. He held all his followers in a grip of absolutely fanatical devotion because he controlled the hash. Those who died in battle, he said, went straight to heaven. Those who survived got more hash and fought fanatically. From the Middle East, it spread slowly to other countries, especially in the Muslim world. And again, unlike alcohol, marijuana was never prohibited in the Muslim countries until the Western world forced the prohibition on them. Kief, as it's called in Morocco, was introduced by the Arab conquerors way back about the 7th century, and it's flourished there despite opposition until declared illegal in 54 under American pressure. As you know, it's also widespread in Africa, parts of Latin America. Some of the people of Jamaica call it the wisdom weed, and the current Jamaica radical protest movement uses marijuana as its political symbol. Here's the first stage, kind of pre-Western history of the drug. The second historical stage involves more serious Western interest, but only limited understanding and research. And much of this centered on the hashish club in Paris in the middle of the last century. There was an old neo-Gothic hotel, Pimodon, on the left bank of the Seine. And this is used as the club headquarters by a group of French intellectuals. And among their activities, they used to come together regularly to take marijuana. One of the most famous of this group was Charles Baudelaire, a morbid, somewhat neurotic art historian who joined the club and lodged in an attic in the hotel and describes his experiences. He describes one of his trips in his article, Artificial Paradises, where he attacks the fact that marijuana undermines the structures of morality. And his words are very much a foreshadowing of the modern trip. He writes, "When you have taken the paste, you now have enough ballast for a long and singular voyage. The steam whistle has blown, the sails are set, and you have a curious advantage over ordinary travelers, that of not knowing where you're going. You've made your choice. Hurrah for destiny." And here is the first sort of Western description in terms of a trip. Later on, he was put in an asylum, and he himself partly connected this with his overuse of hash, but actually he had other diseases. In the States, some of the earliest users were some of the friends of Mark Twain. For instance, in 1860, there was a man called Fitzhugh Ludlow who bought some marijuana in a chemist's shop in Poughkeepsie, New York, for only 6 cents. And he used this for years. And at first, he wrote with glowing recommendation. He said, "For the humble sum of 6 cents, I had purchased an excursion ticket all over the world." But later on, reversing his enthusiasm, he described it as the lullaby of hell. So here was the second limited interest and research in the West, mainly among intellectuals, artists, and writers, people who are interested in the intellectual implications of it. The third stage is the recent one of popularization. United Nations statistics in 51 estimated there are over 200 million regular marijuana takers in the world. The first wave to the West came in the 1930s, followed by a second wave, obviously in the bigger wave, in the 1960s. Following these two, the first reaction was one of instant popularity, and the second reaction was one of instant and immediate polarization. And this has plagued the situation ever since. On the one hand, you've had the establishment panic against the drug, and on the other, counterbalancing paranoia by those taking the drug very often. Typical of the panic against marijuana was the extreme campaign by the chief of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, who made all sorts of wild claims about the ill effects of marijuana, saying that it was related to crime and violence, rape and insanity. I quote, "Its continuous use leads direct to the insane asylum." And you can see this irrational panic still reflected in many circles, but fortunately I think the discussion is becoming more balanced. On the other side, the paranoia is equally evident, if understandable. And you can see this in many, many people who take marijuana regularly. Even Ginsberg once admitted, "It's no wonder that most people who smoke marijuana regularly in America often experience a state of anxiety, threat, or paranoia, in fact, which for me sometimes leads to trembling or hysteria. I myself experienced this form of paranoia when I smoked marijuana." Some of the so-called dangers alleged against marijuana in the past have included insanity, sexual perversion, violence, and a dependence link with heroin, the inevitable step down. But if you get into the whole discussion at all, you need to keep in the back of your minds two famous reports which need to be read and understood really to put the present situation in perspective. The first is the report of the Indian Hemp Drug Commission in British India. And this was in 1894. This report is 3,000 pages long, taking up 7 volumes, and is really the classic on marijuana. It took 2 years research with 800 doctors doing the analysis and a tremendous variety. And the report emphatically concluded that there was no evidence of mental, moral, or physical harm. Babs Hagen Mountain Girl, all of his merry pranksters, working out what they call their fantasy, watching their own movie with their psychedelic music and their day-glow paint and their acid. You remember they borrowed an old bus, an old 1939 bus, and marked as its destination on the front further, spelled F-U-U-R-T-H-E-R, etc., and made their crazy trip across the states. Then the climax of the whole thing for them was 66 for the TRIPS Festival, the acid test, the electric Kool-Aid acid test, and so on, also brilliantly described by Tom Wolfe. Others influential in the psychedelic movement would include Hermann Hesse, whose Steppenwolf was the Bible for the first celebration of Leary's group, and whom Leary describes as the poet of the interior journey. Leary would also applaud and include the English, it's what he calls the original hippies. And Leary claims that there's a pedigree of psychedelics, which come down through Humphrey Osmond, Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, R.D. Lang, and Paul McCartney, all English. And somewhat fancifully, he says, the spiritual cord that holds our civilization from suicide can be traced from the Himalayan forests where Vedic philosophers drank soma, down through the Ganges, through the Suez by P&O, and over to Liverpool. Of course, in those early days, acid taking was by no means limited to the counterculture. Among well-known celebrities who also tripped were Cary Grant, and even people like Herman Kahn on the establishment side, and Henry Luce. Let's go on now to look at something of the objections to the psychedelics, and see if these are founded or not. The objections to the psychedelics. What are the normal objections to these drugs, and are these objections valid? Generally speaking, there are two objections. First, that they're dangerous, and secondly, that they are an escape. First, we'll look at the question of their danger. The question of their danger throws light on the present position of psychedelics in the movement today. And this is best illustrated by a discussion of LSD. In 1961, Sidney Cohen, who's a researcher into LSD, did an investigation into over 20,000 trips on 5,000 people. This is 1961, and he concluded that on the basis of all this evidence, LSD gave rise to no serious physical complications, although there were slight side effects, including discomforts, nausea, vomiting, aches and pains, panic, paranoia, and occasional, later undesirable effects. But if the user was unstable already, then there might be psychosis or serious depression. But there were no instances of physical addiction. That was 61. 4 years later, in 65, he was forced to conclude that the incidence, the number of bummers and bad trips, had risen sharply. There was an alarming number of panic states, or of acute paranoia, of notions of omnipotence, people thinking they fly, etc., schizophrenic responses, and marked character alterations in some of the people, as well as possible nerve cell damage and the fear of chromosomal alterations. And Cohen attributed some of this to the drug itself, but some of it also to the creation of the black market, the sale of impure drugs, and the improper use, all of this created by the fact that society was coming down so hard and often so irrational against it, but some of it was the drugs itself. This has had some effect on the eventual swing away from the psychedelics. But perhaps one other reason for their decline is their inadequacy. In fact, even those who don't use them today, because they feel they're inadequate, such as Alan Watts, defend them despite their dangers. Alan Watts wrote, "Every worthwhile exploration is dangerous. It was hardly hygienic for Jesus to get himself crucified. But there must be risks to be taken in the course of any spiritual adventure." So he defends the fact that they're dangerous and doesn't discount them on that account. But what we've seen today is that for many, the swing from LSD is not so much a swing away because they're dangerous as a swing beyond because they're inadequate. The psychedelics are unable to take one to the higher areas of transcendental consciousness, which can be reached better by more subtle meditative techniques. Robert Dorop, in his book, The Master Game, Beyond the Drug Experience, writes, or rather claims that drugs lead only to mental and physical exhaustion, a form of what he calls spiritual burglary. And his warning is echoed by many Eastern gurus and Western psychologists. Durop writes, "He who misuses psychedelics sacrifices his capacity to develop by persistently squandering those inner resources upon which growth depends. He commits himself to a descending spiral. And the further he travels down this path, the more difficult it becomes for him to reascend." Now, probably only a comparative few fall foul of the dangers of these drugs. Comparative few compared with the vast number who take them. Although, sadly, this comparative few includes many, many extreme tragedies. But the proportion of those who succumb to the second objection, the offer of escape, is much higher. Let's look into this one. Early on, Baudelaire called marijuana an escape from the hopeless darkness of ordinary daily existence. Even Leary admits, quote, the age-old appeal of the psychedelic experience is its solution to the problem of escape. The visionary revelation answers the escape question. There is no death. Ecstatic, mirthful relief. It is of interest that the heroin addict and the illuminated Buddha end up at the same place, the void. Certainly it's a complaint of many of the activists today and the radicals politically that those who regularly use the psychedelics with the goals of consciousness free in mind eventually end at the place where dropout becomes cop-out. In other words, they charge that the resort to psychedelics is parallel to the happiness supplied in the Brave New World by Soma. Many who turn on regularly or just indulge in a periodic freakout are just flirting with answers or escaping the real issues. But whether they do it regularly as an intentional motive or as the end result of a habit, undoubtedly escapism and the mentality of escapism that it breeds figures heavily in our generation's use of the psychedelics. 2 years ago, I was passing a cafe in Kathmandu, Nepal. I was amazed to hear some Dylan music coming out of through the doors. I looked in and saw about 25 young Americans and Europeans sitting at long trestle tables with their heads right down in their arms. And as the door creaked as I went in, all of them just looked up like this with heavy, glazed eyes, and then slowly looked down again, totally unseeing. And there's a group there who were stoned constantly, 24 hours a day, like sort of perpetual zombies. And many of these, if you talk to them, have literally come to Nepal just to die. They are the extremes of the case, but there are many others in the gradation way down the line, for whom undoubtedly the psychedelics have an element of escapism in the reasons and the results for why they take the psychedelics, the objections. Now let's have a couple minutes break. We'll continue. Now we'll get into the heart of the discussion, which is to try and see what the implications of these things are. And first of all, let's try and chart the psychedelic experience. What exactly is the nature of the psychedelic experience? As I said earlier, as the psychedelics disinhibit the normal rational waking mind, they appear to act like a series of optical lenses, raising the levels of conscious awareness. Now, according to Tim Leary, there are six levels of consciousness. I give you his analysis. It's hotly disputed, but I give it to you because it's typical of the type of claims that are made by the avid users of the drugs. So this, according to Leary, is the six levels of awareness. The first level is minimal or anesthetic consciousness, the consciousness of sleep or coma or stupor. In other words, at this level, below the normal rational waking level, only the very sharp external stimuli are noticed. And you can get down to this level by falling asleep it can be induced through alcohol or barbiturates or narcotics. The second level is symbolic consciousness, the normal consciousness of our waking minds, the level at which external objects are seen as external objects. In other words, I know myself to be myself and not you, not the carpet, not the table, not the chair, etc., the level at which hopefully we all are at the moment. The third level is external sensory awareness, the consciousness which seems to focus on the sensory nerve endings. In other words, the nerve endings that receive information from outside, the retina of the eye, the eardrum, the taste buds. the external sensory awareness. The fourth level is the internal sensory awareness, where he says our consciousness seems to be on the nerve endings buried within the body, which receive impulses from the sexual, digestive, cardiac organs, etc. The fifth level is the cellular consciousness. And at this level, Leary claims, consciousness focuses on life in the cells themselves. And the sixth level is what he calls the pre-cellular consciousness, atomic level, where he says one is conscious of the ultimate state of being, pure energy, very close to what the mystics describe as the void, or the white light, or the flame. Now, only at this last level does Leary appear at all hesitant. At all the other levels, Leary is quite confident that his ideas are correct. But he admits that at the last level, he runs the risk of losing even the least skeptical of his readers. And many people dispute this analysis, but I'll just give you it as an example. He also admits that the various drugs, as expanding optical lenses, can take one to greater or lesser depths of awareness. So he says, marijuana will reach only the internal sensory awareness, unless you're very disciplined mentally and other external stimuli are shut out. While at the fifth level, moderate doses of LSD and mescaline are successful only if the external stimuli are shut out, and marijuana or mild doses of LSD are insufficient. And at the sixth level, he says, only large doses of LSD are finally effective. But it's then that the vital question comes, what exactly is this world of the transcendental consciousness? And how is the drug-induced consciousness related to other forms of consciousness? Now, these questions are still a puzzle, and inevitably so, because they're in the imprecise area of mysticism. So I'd stress that any attempt to go into this area is bound to be extremely tentative and speculative. So I would stress that. What I'm saying now is just totally speculative. It may be entirely wrong, maybe you can see that in a year's time or so, but it's what I've thought through to the best of my ability in the amount of books that I've read personally. This is what I'd say. Probably, what we call the normal rational waking consciousness is a highly limited scanning beam of concentrated awareness focused on a small area of reality, deliberately excluding all unnecessary peripheral awareness. In other words, unnecessary, that is, for normal living, which itself is a relative thing with cultural with variations. But beyond this normal rational consciousness is an ecstatic world of unusual perceptions, which you could describe as paranormal and transcendental. And this is what we're trying to get into, the hazy outline of the boundaries of this world. And this would have to include various areas. William James describes it as the subliminal or transmarginal region. Richard Buck describes it as the cosmic consciousness. C.G. Jung describes it as the collective unconscious. And Huxley describes it as mind at large. In other words, that paranormal, transcendental world outside the comparatively limited focus of normal, rational, waking consciousness. Now, what is this? Maybe normal, rational, waking consciousness functions like a scanning beam, a searchlight, mounted on a carriage, a railway carriage, as it were, which is itself only able to move slightly on a track with two terminals. So you've got this scanning beam of consciousness moving with slight variations up and down a track, whose twin terminals are insanity and unsanity. In other words, the sanity that's paranormal beyond what we can see and so on. But the point is, as I'll show you later on with diagrams, the track is not straight like this. The track is bent in the shape of a horseshoe. So that normal rational waking consciousness is here, and the twin terminals come round here in the area of the paranormal and almost touch, but don't quite. All right? The track is not straight. It's bent in the shape of a horseshoe, so there's still a narrow gap where the two terminals almost meet. But since this meeting point is beyond the range of the scanning beam of normal consciousness, we'll have to distinguish it from the sanity of normal consciousness. I'll put up diagrams later. So the normal consciousness here you could call sanity. Everything outside this is paranormal, transcendental. But you can go one of two ways in the paranormal. You can go to what we'll call insanity, i.e. that which is mentally unhealthy, or you can go to a sanity which is paranormal, which we'll call, for the sake of definition, unsanity. That word there is taken from Sidney Cohen's book. In other words, normal consciousness is sanity. and the two terminals, both beyond normal perception in the world of the paranormal, are unsanity and insanity, respectively. By this definition, both insanity and unsanity are paranormal, but insanity is considered unhealthy, while unsanity is considered healthy. As I say, I'll put up an illustration on the board to show you this later. Now, in these types of mysticism, on the positive side, we're dealing then with a paranormal world, which hopefully is unsanity. In other words, a paranormal sanity, which we're defining as unsanity, but not insanity. On the side of unsanity, various mystical experiences could perhaps be charted in the geography of the transcendental. And these would include all sorts of things. For example, on a very limited level, they include peak experiences. Those rare sudden moments of insight and rapture and bliss. Anything can trigger it off. Or it could introduce what's called integration experiences. And by that I mean mystical experiences where there is neither any enlargement of the personality, but only an awareness of the self-realization of the personality, which transcends the space-time awareness of my present individuality. Or thirdly, you could have what you might call a pan-naturalist experience, an awareness of nature in all things and of all things being as one, without reference to the idea of God. Another one would be pantheistic experiences, identical with the latter, but this time relating the idea to God, who is one with nature, so that nature is God and God is nature. Or you could have isolationist experiences, which is virtually the goal of yoga and Zen, or the highest mystical experiences possible in the theism of the Muslims, the Sufis, and so on. Now, many of these positive experiences, all of which are in the area of unsanity, have some form of negative counterpart, which are in the area approaching the opposite terminal of insanity. So the Muslim mystics speak of the fact you can have a mystical experience of elation and expansion, or of constriction and distortion. Or in the area of peak experiences, you can have experiences of a sense of integration, or you can have experiences on the other side of a sense of disintegration and distortion and things falling apart. You can have a good trip or a bummer. So quite where these two areas meet, no one quite knows. There seem to be the two terminals of the idea. Now, if we try and do justice to this geography of the transcendental, we'd have to take into account two obvious but counterbalancing facts. First, prior conceptions condition later perceptions. In other words, the way you think before you trip will condition what you think in the trip. So there may be a great variety in experiences of the mystical trips. This does not mean that they're experiencing that many different things. They may just be having different trips because of different types of experiences or different types of theology or conceptions behind them. That's the first thing. Secondly, though, the data, in fact, is of such total variety that probably it cannot all be explained as issuing from an identical experience. In other words, you have some people who say, basically, you only have one experience, and men all over the world rationalize it differently, and this is their theology, psychology, religion, etc. But there are so many extreme differences that probably you can't rationalize them all down to one basic trip. It's true that the common factor of all these experiences is that in some sense they are unitive. In other words, they're experiences of being one with something or someone other than oneself, whom before the transcendence one did not feel oneself one with. But of course this leaves unanswered the question as to what one is united with. And I think it's here that the variety begins, and the evidence must be carefully sifted. Many factors, obviously, could affect the variety, such as, is the trip because of a meditation technique or because of drugs? It could be a difference because of your a priori conception. The man who's a psychoanalyst will have one conception, the man who's a pantheist another. Or there could be different trips because of the objects of mysticism with which one feels one. One man may actually be having an experience of nature, and one may actually be having experience of the occult, even the occult through nature. In other words, all these factors will vary the types of trip. But basically, they're all experiences that are unitive in one sense or the other. If this is true, the psychedelic drugs are but one means among many of altering the consciousness. Other suggested analogs to the psychedelic experience, and this is what people are suggesting, might include meditation, hypnosis, And among the well-practiced means to achieve transcendence, the various techniques such as breathing, use of chants, oscillating body movements, and self-flagellation. All these are only means. The point I stress is these can be directed either towards the transcendental world of unsanity, i.e. positive, or misdirected towards the depression and distortion of the world approaching insanity. Hindu meditation, for example, is a highly developed technique designed to eliminate the external stimuli by zeroing in only one of the senses, such as the eye via a mandala, or the ear via a mantra, or the taste and touch and smell via tantra. They do this to the point where you zero in on one of the senses and the mind is disinhibited and achieves the transcendental consciousness, which is the bliss of yoga. The Maharishi often explains his meditation like this. If you have a glass of water, at which the bottom represents the place where the mind joins the subconscious, the top of the glass, the wider part, represents our conscious mind, then bubbles coming up will get bigger and bigger and bigger as they break surface, as you imagine them. The bottom represents the subconscious, and the top are conscious minds, where thoughts and ideas break surface and are expressed or appreciated. Now, normally, when you listen to a lecture or a conversation or a concert or anything normally, or you read a book and you hear sounds, what happens is that sounds and words and thoughts pass across the surface of our minds, i.e. in ear, in one ear and out the other usually, and they have no permanence in our minds. So when I went to an ashram and they started us in meditation, the very first thing they did is to say, meditate on this music for half an hour and tell us your reactions. Everyone was so desperately keen to say the right thing at the end. You know, they didn't know what to say. And then everyone had to admit, well, it just went in one ear and out the other. And they said, well, that's what we wanted you to say. But the effect of the mantra, rather than that, is to be a symbolic sound that represents the name and the nature of the deity. And the idea is that instead of going in one ear and out the other across the surface of the glass of water at the top, rather to form a continuous circle within the mind. And when this is done, the thought stays within the conscious mind, and then, as it were, it proceeds down the bubble stream backwards. In other words, when it reaches the bottom, thought is not just appreciated at its conscious level, but at all the subtler levels too. And finally, you bring the subconscious mind within the range of the conscious, and the power of the conscious mind is thereby increased manyfold. That's how the Maharishi explains his meditation. Some people suggest that some forms of sensory deprivation even can lead to experiences like this. In other words, the normal mind requires constant feedback of external stimuli. And if these are lacking, if you suffer deprivation, at certain points you can have hallucinations or even a transcendental consciousness. And this occasionally happens to cave explorers, solitary shipwrecked sailors, drivers crossing vast stretches of the glaring desert, or elderly hospital patients whose eyes are bandaged and have very restricted movements. Or it can even happen to a normal person in a totally soundless, lightless, senseless room. Maybe this is a possible explanation of some of the mysticisms of the past. For example, the Egyptian temple rites involved sensory deprivations, fasting, social isolation in the cells, and then eventually they had hallucinatory experiences. The Sioux Indians have a sun ritual of heat and thirst, which leads them eventually to a crude delirium. The Sufis practice long breath retentions and vigils of abstinence, which achieve this transcendental consciousness. And maybe the same thing was behind the Delphic Oracle. Thus, it could be that psychedelics, Zen meditation, yoga, nature mysticism, aesthetic mysticism, all of these may very well be analogs or different paths to the same transcendental world. Now, of course, I stress the experiences are all very different, and not all the trips arise at precisely the same destination. But then, as we've seen, even within the limited range of psychedelics, marijuana is less powerful than acid, etc. On this point, whether meditation and acid take you to the same place, I heard long discussions between the gurus and the acid heads in India. And the gurus would argue that without the ethics and without the discipline of yoga, a genuine transcendental consciousness, or bliss, is impossible. But many of the acid heads would come back and reply that they'd tried both meditation and drugs, and the difference was not one of kind, but only of degree. All of you know Donald. Donald's a very seasoned alpine climber. I suspect that Donald would be more than a little scornful if he climbed the Matterhorn again. He's climbed it 3 times already. Only to discover when he got to the top of the Matterhorn that someone had been lowered there by helicopter.